Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's prime time for winter blues for those who get them. But there's not much accommodation made in our age of climate control and year-round productivity expectations. Most of us just slog through. All of us, says my guest today, psychiatrist John Sharp, feel the physical and emotional toll of the seasons, plus our own private calendars. He's looked at how to recognize what's going on, how to live with the seasons. This hour on Point, we're looking at the emotional calendar of life. We will hear in this hour from the wonderful writer Rick Bragg, whose work and characters breathe with season. Joining me now in the studio is John Sharp, a psychiatrist and neuropsychiatrist. He splits his time between Los Angeles and Boston on the faculty of UCLA and Harvard Medical Schools, on the medical staff at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. His new book is The Emotional Calendar, Understanding Seasonal Influences and Milestones to Become Happier, More Fulfilled, and in Control of Your Life. John Sharp, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be here.
Happier, more fulfilled, and in control of our lives. It sounds like we would all like to have that.
That's the goal.
We'll get to the emotions. Let's start with just the physical. I mean, you say everybody's body, first of all, is dealing with the weather, and I presume that's not just shivering when we go outside on a cold day.
No, you know, our senses are so attuned to light and temperature and humidity, and, you know, there are sensory associations that you're not even aware of, not stuff that's deeply buried, but just outside of your awareness so that you can think about whatever it is you'd like to be thinking about. But physiologically, we are so sensitive, we're affected all the time.
Homeostasis is the word you use for what our body's always trying to achieve. What is that?
It's an old word. It actually came from physics, talking about achieving a kind of dynamic equilibrium, a kind of balance. And whether it's physiologic or emotional, actually they're linked. Being in physiologic balance can lead to being in emotional balance. So it's a state of dynamic well-being where you can actually feel in control, you can respond to what you're sensing and feel like you're able to manage and feel competent as a result.
It's kind of like a thermostat within us. I mean, things change around us, the climate, the seasons, the temperature, the humidity, on, and our body's always trying to get to some mean.
Yes, absolutely. And you don't have to think at all about it. It's happening all by itself. But when you increase your awareness of what's happening, you can take more into account. So if you're being affected by the slant of light in winter, for example, not just the fact that there's less light, but, you know, it looks different coming through the bare branches. And if that reminds you of other times in your life, and if you feel that in your body, and if you know that's what's happening, you can chart your course more successfully.
But when we feel that, and the associations we have that, and some may be good, some may be bad,
right,
there's a physical undergirding to all that. I mean, you sort of tick off a list, but tell us about it. Pulmonary, what, immune system, hormone secretions, gastrointestinal. How are those basic physical things affected by whether it's summer or winter?
You read the book. It's all there. It's true. You know, when you look at what I call the science of seasonality, and let me just say that when I tried to put this together, I had to look far and wide. It's not really all organized in one place. The emotional calendar kind of puts it together in one place for the first time. The effect, for example, of light on serotonin receptors in brain science is one of the newest things that we've discovered recently. You can actually look at the density of serotonin receptors in the brain, which correlate with mood and mood reactivity, and you can see changes, how there's actually less in the winter, more in the summer. You can look separately, say, at lymph organs and see that there's actually growth and expansion in lymphatic tissues in the fall, we believe associated with immunology and more allergens and having to fight off infections. So, you know, I could take you through all of them, but basically all of our systems have a kind of seasonal reactivity, which we didn't necessarily know or make sense of for a long time.
So that leaves me wondering how much of our response to seasons is really a response to the way our bodies are experiencing them and how much is psychological. You've got these wonderful literary allusions all through here. Let me read one from Yoko Ono. She kind of nailed it for a lot of people here. This is from her Season of Glass. Yoko Ono says, "Spring passes and one remembers one's innocence. Summer passes and one remembers one's exuberance. Autumn passes and one remembers one's reverence. Winter passes and one remembers one's perseverance."
That's a pretty good nut in a nutshell. And then here's one from Marcel Proust. A change in the weather is sufficient to recreate the world and ourselves. We all know what he's talking about there. How much of that sense of recreation of our change with the seasons is just us responding to different hormones, secretions, and how much of it is a psychological imprint, the fingerprints of past experience associated with the season?
That's a great question. You know, the mind is located in the body, right? We are both the protagonist in our life, and we're also the observer of ourselves. So our understanding of how we're feeling is rooted in our brain function and in our physiology. Now, you know, you could take issue with that. You could take religious issue or spiritual issue, but basically you're right. It does still come down to the fact that we live in our bodies, and when our bodies are sensing something powerfully, our mind is brought back to it. It's not just a memory in the sense of, oh, I can think about this and now I know how I felt then. It's reliving it. You know, memories don't exist in time. Like in Proust, when he ate that precious Madeleine, mm-hmm. he was brought back to his childhood. That's what he was reliving, and that's what happens to us really every day.
So it's a combination then of memory and sort of the body triggering memory to make that experience current and real. What percentage of people have real difficulty with this? I mean, I know a lot of people who just, they may gripe on a super hot day or on a super cold day today in Boston. But in general, they love the seasons. But others really get whacked around by a seasonal change. What percentage of people have difficulty with it?
Well, 2 points. One is I do think that everybody is going to be whacked around to some degree. It kind of depends how stoic you are, how resilient you are, how seasonally sensitive you are. You know, we believe that there's about 10 or 20% of people who are exquisitely seasonally sensitive, who react to light and noise and wind, people who are very emotional and moody, who feel the need to be in control, oftentimes who suffer migraines more. There's a whole interesting correlation between all these different factors that seems to point to one thing, which is a kind of exquisite seasonal sensitivity. So people who have seasonal affective disorder, for example, which we can talk about, don't only miss the light. They also are probably suffering in a broader variety of ways because of this seasonal sensitivity.
And you're saying 10% of the population is more attuned, more vulnerable to bigger swings of emotion?
Probably 10 or 20%. There are not yet terrific studies on this. So what we're doing is we're extracting data from different populations, looking at answers to different questions, and it seems to aggregate to around 10 to 20%.
Seasonal affective disorder, we think of in terms of light. People get big sun lamps and put around the house to sort of counteract that. But did I hear you mention also noise as a calendrical issue or wind?
Absolutely. You know, wind itself, if you're out in the prairies in Iowa or in the Alps or really anywhere where there's a howling, consistent wind, it's disturbing. You know, this isn't rocket science, but this is basic physiology. People are disturbed by persistent winds. And it may be that the same people who are sensitive to light and noise and temperature, more so than the general population, are going to be disturbed in the same way by this wind sensitivity.
We're going to hear in this hour from the great Rick Bragg. I want to hear from a lot of callers as well. The doctor is in, John Sharp, psychiatrist, neuropsychiatrist, talking about the emotional calendar, the title of his new book. Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, thanks for calling. You're on the air with John Sharp.
Hi. Well, it's interesting for me because I'm quite the opposite. I absolutely treasure winter and love the pre-dawn hours. In fact, I'm one of these foolish people who walks 2 hours before dawn, sometimes at 4:30 to around 7. I have a woman friend named Amy who often walks with me.
Did you do it today? And two degrees, 5 degrees below zero?
Of course. It's not that bad. I mean,
you
put on two scarves. You know, your neck, and you bundle up, maybe even with a third. But if you walk, your body begins to get warm.
Yeah.
And what I treasure, especially, say, this morning, was the brightness of the gibbous moon, seeing the pre-summer stars, and just being in that quiet space. It's almost like opening the door a little bit on something totally otherwise. And I adore it. I do it every single day, and I have for almost 2 years now.
Peter, I'm thrilled to hear that.
I think I was reincarnated as a, or that I've come from a polar bear or something, you know.
I love it, Peter, and I'm so glad for your call because, of course, seasons, they can send some into a funk, but they can also, every season, can send people just soaring, that wonderful penumbra of light with the sunrise in the winter, the clarity of the light Peter's talking about. I mean, it may be the blues for some, but it's ecstasy for others, John.
You know, I think it's a beautiful example of what I call seasonal embrace. So, Peter, what you're doing is you're enjoying what the season has to offer. You're getting into it instead of fighting against it. And I think that that's the correct thing for everyone to try to do, and I'm glad it comes so naturally and so enjoyably for you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I guess the winter makes you laugh a little slower, makes you talk a little lower about the things you could not show her. And it's been a long December, and there's reason to believe maybe this year will be better than last. I can't remember all the times I tried to tell myself to hold on to these moments as they pass.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the emotional ups and downs of the seasons, what drives them, and how to work through them with psychiatrist John Sharp. His new book is The Emotional Calendar. He's got a lot of wonderful literary allusions woven through the pages of this book. Here's George Santayana on springtime. To be interested in the changing seasons is a happier state of mind than to be hopelessly in love with spring, as in spring only. Let's get our callers in here. So many. Tom in Wareham, Massachusetts. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Pretty well. Even on this very cold winter day, I'm loving it.
It's frigid, man. So I couldn't be any more different than your previous caller, growing up at least. I've lived my whole life in Massachusetts, and I've always been a pessimist about the winter. Clearing off my car, trying to get it started,
yeah.
Generally freezing, and just feeling awful and saying, I hate this, I can't wait to move, I can't wait to get out of here.
Okay.
And so basically, I'm 22 now, but when I turned 18, I packed up and moved to San Diego, and went to school at UC San Diego in sunny La Jolla for 2 years. And the strangest thing about it was that in the wintertime, especially in the winter months, I found myself almost used to the rhythm of being miserable, and I found myself trying to find things to complain about because it's really hard to complain about the weather in San Diego.
Right.
And then there'd be a strange guilt that would almost come with that when I'd find myself seasonally depressed in a place that doesn't have seasons.
So with or without the seasons, you could be up against it. I mean, did it leave you longing to get back to them, Tom?
I moved home. 2 years, I couldn't take it. I had to come home. I need the weather to complain about is what I've realized.
It gives you the grist for your mill. I love it, Tom. Thank you very much. And it's interesting, John, because you have practices and faculty positions on both coasts. So what about it? What do you see? You're part of the time in New England, very distinct four seasons. Then you're out in L.A. where to a New Englander's eyes, it all gets sort of mushed together. Do you see how do seasons work in California? Do people still have seasonal issues, an emotional calendar?
Yeah, you know, they do. It's not as big a difference, obviously, between summer and winter, but there are slight differences, and that's enough mm-hmm. to trigger seasonal appreciation that I think is useful for people to get more into. Tom's experience is really interesting for us to take a look at, too, because, you know, he got used to the kind of winter feeling that he grew up with, so much so that even moving, it didn't go away. You know, that's a great example of conditioning through experience. And I think, you know, there are two solutions to that. One is go back to what works for you, even though it wasn't a happy experience, it was familiar and to that extent comforting. Or, you know, you could have stuck it out in San Diego, man. And I think if you had, what would have happened is over the years, you would have found that you could enjoy winter without, you know, missing that kind of sense of unhappiness, which frankly got you out there in the first place.
Here's Beverly online. Says, this is something I can relate to. For 2 or 3 years, I had some sort of problem, not sure of the cause. Autumn had been her favorite season, but it began to depress her. All that lay ahead of her, the cold, bleak, colorless winter, the thoughts of dead car batteries, dead birds, animals, plants, shoveling snow. And then her husband, knowing her love for flowers, she says, bought me a winter flowering houseplant, then another and another, with almost miraculous results. Sounds like she's got a whole greenhouse full now, and she's fine again.
He helped her to rebrand the fall. So now she sees it as a growing season, a time when she can look forward to. And prior to that, she had suffered from a lot of kind of premature unhappiness in the fall. In other words, thinking that it's kind of like winter already. I often tell patients, don't, you know, see the fall as being like tantamount to winter. It's a lovely season in and of itself. It starts off mild. It's beautiful. True, in the end, it's wintry. But don't race ahead seasonally and kind of miss out on what you can enjoy.
You've got Pablo Neruda here, Neruda on winter. It shows up, the winter, splendid dictation bestowed on me by slow leaves, suited up in silence and yellow. I'm a book of snow, a wide hand, a prairie, an expectant circumference. I pertain to earth and its winter. You know, it's interesting how people experience these things. I was wondering as I read this, you present it as though we can almost just think our way out of whatever response that we have. I remember years as a teenager when I found I love midwinter, but I must have been 15, 16, 17, I found February just unbearable.
Because what?
I don't know why, but now I don't. And I wonder if maybe it's something to do with the hormones of being 16. Is it really all within our power just to think our way through and out of? Or could it be that for some reason, at that time of my life, I wasn't young enough to have that many horrible associations with February? I just found it difficult.
Right. Now, you would have known if you had horrible associations. You know, they're not hidden. You would have known what it was you were upset about. And those hormones of a 16-year-old can probably make anything unbearable for a while. But I think what you're suggesting is that we can mature. You know, we can kind of grow up, grow out of a funk or a kind of a prior pattern. And it's not just thinking your way through. It's also kind of believing in yourself and understanding, you know, demystifying what it is that's affecting you.
But I feel, since I never really put any, work in on it to change, I sort of have the feeling that my body just was bothered by it then and isn't now somehow.
Interesting. I mean, the differential would be that either you're a very healthy man and you were just able to kind of self-correct without having to, actively think about what goes into that. Or maybe there was something physiologic. You know, it's not either or. Maybe there was something physiologic that somehow you're more
At different
adapted.
Periods in life. I mean, certainly maybe it's the same with all people, but I was more mercurial in general in those years than now.
And that may have gone along with being a little bit less tolerant.
Of the seasons. Let's get a call from back that prairie way. Alita is calling from Normal, Illinois. Know it very well. Hi, Alita. It's great to have you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
It was like, you're addressing a subject that it describes me to a T. I have personal experience with this. As a child, when I was 9, I was involved in a plane crash, and my father and my cousin died instantly, and I was knocked unconscious. And when the ambulance came to get me, it was out in the prairie and in the farm field, and they had to cut me out of the plane and then, load me up in the ambulance. It was that very thin light of winter because it was Christmas Day. It was late afternoon, and the sun was getting ready to set. And that time of day and that thin winter light at the end of the summertime would just really just make me cringe. And
after that tragedy, after that crash and that day, you mean, Alita?
Oh, yes, after that day. It just was so reminiscent. It was like dragging me back to the scene every time. So for many, many years I've had problems, and I would just retreat maybe to the basement during the later afternoon hours in the wintertime and
to escape that light that would sort of trigger those memories. Have you managed to get around it, or is it still a problem?
Yes, I did. I had about 5 years of therapy, adopted a little girl, and after getting married, and my life is so very different now. And now I'm to the point where instead of having to go down to the basement and light candles or something like that to get away from the sunset, I actually want to sit in the waning sunlight and soak up the very last bit of it, and it pains me to have any errands that I have to do that keep me out of the late sunshine in the wintertime. So.
Lita, I so appreciate that story and that call. I mean, it's really interesting, and I'm glad you've made that turn out of it. But this goes to John Sharp. It's not only about the seasons in themselves, but it's our experiences within the entire calendar that can trigger things, not just seasons, but anniversaries of loss or tragedy like this can work into what you call the emotional calendar, John.
Absolutely. No, thank you so much for that call. It's such a terrific example of how you're able to help yourself along. You know, first, avoiding some painful triggers is not a bad idea, but not as a long-term plan. Then you've got to kind of find a way forward in your life and to try to make positive associations so that you can look forward to new traditions in your life, I think is probably the best way to do it. That kind of conditioning through experience, you know, something that happened being a major source of concern and emotion is absolutely natural. And what we want to do is to kind of honor that and then find a way forward in our lives.
Of course, it's interesting. The same associations can be tragic or they can be wondrous, depending on what you've experienced in different seasons. You quote so many great writers in here, including one who's a real favorite of ours, Rick Bragg, author of The Most They Ever Had, The Prince of Frogtown, and a lot more. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, but also professor of writing at University of Alabama. Rick is with us right now from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Rick, thank you very much for joining us today.
No, it's my pleasure, Tom.
Hi, Rick.
John's quoting some of your work from Dinner Rights in here. It's a piece you had in Food and Wine a couple years back and talking about Thanksgiving. But we wanted to tap you a little bit, Rick, just for your sense as a writer, that means you know human character, how that comes into your writing in terms of conveying people and the seasons in which we see them in your work. How strong an issue is that?
Well, it's very strong. I think us Southerners are a little afraid of winter. Up north, winter comes in like this elderly uncle who you know is going to arrive at around Thanksgiving, and he's going to stay and stay and stay and make things a little uncomfortable, and he's going to leave sometime around spring.
Yep.
In the Deep South, winter is a sneak thief. You know, it comes in for a day or two, you know, bursts your pipes.
Pops you in the nose.
Yeah, runs out or knocks you down in the driveway.
Right.
You know, so it's we tend to loathe what little bit of winter we have down here.
Take us to the other end of it. Rick, you had the wonderful biography of your grandfather and Ava's Man back in 2001, and you associate him very strongly in there with the summer side of Alabama life.
I think a lot of people who write about the Deep South and write about the people in it tend to write in kind of a perpetual summer. But to me, it was always more fun to think of him, so I wrote about it this way. The foothills vanish altogether in the winter, when the rain and the low clouds drift in, turning everything gray. Then the temperature drops, and the rain freezes solid to the pines, and the weight of it snaps off their limbs with a sound like pistol shots. And you can stand and listen to it, like a pitched battle in the woods, if you have the time. But now that I have a picture of my grandfather, I imagine him always in summer, always in his boat made from two car hoods welded together, feeling for the sand at the bottom of the river with the end of his pole, and the boat glides and glides. We just like writing about our people in summer.
And two car hoods welded together to make a boat. That's fantastic. Do you...
It was... They got by with whatever they could get. And whenever I asked people about this man, they always told me a story of summer, as though... he went into hibernation in winter and didn't exist.
Well, what does that say to you? As a writer, as a Southerner, do we all just live more fully in the summer? Are we right to be a little bit bummed in the winter if we've had to shut down, hibernate a little bit? Or do you just roll with it? Do your characters roll with it?
Well, I think up north, the great northern writers that I know, they roll with it. The characters just keep trudging through the snow, but... I think it has to do with how prepared we are. And we just don't get enough winter to really plan itself in our consciousness.
I think that the preparation that you make is great. Rick, by the way, you're such an amazing writer, and you put characters into such intense places, and the feelings that are evoked are so vivid. I just want to say you're absolutely right. What I often tell people to do is to think of the seasons as their own worlds. Think of the winter as a whole different world than the fall, the spring, and the summer, with its own tastes and sounds and smells and flavors and pleasures and dislikes.
But if winter shows up so spottily, as in Rick's Alabama, you never know when it's going to be there. You can't brace yourself for, as he says, the uncle who's going to stay for 4 months. And,
so without being prepared, it is hard. Absolutely. Preparation does make a big difference, and experience.
So, Rick, when you sit down to write, is it always summer in your mind in Alabama? Have you ever put the winter front and center, or does that just somehow step out of the flow?
No, I have, and I have written about it. My mother hates winter. She looks at winter the way I think people look at the gulag. She sees the temperature dropping below freezing as though she's going to live in a tundra. And I think that comes from, like a lot of mountain south southerners, they grew up very poor. And, they talk of winter as whistling through the floorboards of the shacks that they lived in. They talk of winter as a man... a homeless man, an old drunk, you know, frozen in the ditch on the side of the road. There is a real bleakness, real tragedy to winter in the stories that they tell. And I know that Northerners would laugh at us and say, you don't even get winter. But in the mountain south, you get kind of a quick, stabbing, ugly winter.
And it is a season of death and decay. You know, I mean, Northerners who love to run outside and go skiing and layer up, put their face in the sun, would say otherwise. But the natural thing about winter is that death and decay. It's very evocative, and you're describing it just the way it is for most people.
Not to mention that this winter we've seen really low temperatures in pretty big parts of the South, places where people have zero insulation in those wooden walls, Rick.
To give you an idea, my wife took me on a forced march of Washington, D.C. and New York over the holidays.
Mm.
And I had to buy gloves and a hat. I didn't own gloves and a hat.
Better keep them.
We just kind of hope winter will come in when we're not looking and be gone.
Rick Bragg, you are terrific, and we're really grateful for that that little reading from Ava's Man. Just beautiful.
No, it is my pleasure. This is fun.
Well, I appreciate you being with us.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Rick Bragg there from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Pulitzer Prize winner, author of Ava's Man, The Prince of Frogtown, the most they ever had, with his taste of his own people and his own characters as they experience the seasons and emotions in those seasons. John Sharp, psychiatrist, neuropsychiatrist, is with us. His new book is The Emotional Calendar. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the emotional ups and downs of the seasons, what drives them, how to work through them, with psychiatrist John Sharp. His new book is The Emotional Calendar. Let's get a call from New York, Canton, New York, and Connie. Hi, Connie, you're on the air with John Sharp.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Connie.
I have an experience and a question about it.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 70s, then again in the late 70s, I had a couple of breakdowns,
yep.
Pretty much the same time of year, and then a minor breakdown again in the 90s. And I'm curious as to whether the precipitating thing was the season or the breakdown. Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I'm sorry, Connie, you said you take vacations at that time?
In November now, and go where there's nice weather.
So November was when you hit the pothole in all three of those instances, Connie?
Yep, early November.
Well, very interesting. You know, you've asked yourself the question, is it something that's seasonally triggered? Is it something that I'm reacting to in my life? Was there some kind of preceding, you know, loss or disruption that caused you to suffer like that you could find, or no?
No, because all three were different causes. You know, there were different things going on in my life all three times.
And do you feel like the winter does kind of take a toll on you? Do you feel you have a little bit of seasonal affective disorder or subsyndromal seasonal affective disorder? So that may have brought it out. You know, that may be a precipitating factor, you know, that kind of makes you more vulnerable. And then there was the just timing that you're now used to and suffering.
Connie, has it led you to fear November? Are you apprehensive as it approaches, given that history?
No, because as I say, I do try to get away.
Yeah.
That's adaptive, you know, knowing that this is a time when it's better for you to get away and have something to look forward to that's positive. That's putting something positive into effect, so you're not just kind of a victim of circumstance.
Connie, that's terrific. I appreciate your call very much, and enjoy those Novembers, however you figure out how to do it. Let's get one more here from Tracy in Ashland, Massachusetts. Tracy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm originally from Hawaii.
Great.
And beautiful Hawaii, and I suffer from seasonal affective disorder, and I'm wondering, is it just part of my DNA that I suffer from seasonal affective disorder, even if I didn't come from a beautiful place like Hawaii? Is it just part of me, or I don't know, is it because I come from there?
Tracy, do you live year-round in the Northeast now?
Yes, I do, but I try to make it back home about three times a year.
Oh, lucky you. How do you deal with that, other than flying to Hawaii, which we could all probably benefit from now and then, how do you deal with it when you're in the winter dark and cold?
Well, our house has big windows. My husband for Christmas,
Oh, Tracy, I'm losing your cell, but we've got your question. John Sharp, how about it? Is it baked in the cake, regardless of where Tracy's from, or might she have this because she grew up in Hawaii with its climate and then moved to another? What do you say?
You know what? It's certainly not your fault, Tracy. It's not because you have some defect or because you started off in a sunnier place and now it's not so sunny. It really is something that you can deal with in terms of light therapy, though. You know, that's one easy fix for seasonal affective disorder, whether you had it as a kid or not, whether you moved or not. We know in America, the farther you get away from the equator, the less sunlight you have, those long winter nights, the more you're likely to be affected. And the fix, Tom, is just a bright light box, 10,000 lux. That's a unit of light intensity. Staring not at the bulb, but just having the light shine on your face for 20 or 30 minutes a day will really help you be relieved of that burden. So it'll help your energy, concentration, your mood, it'll help your sleep, help you feel like you can enjoy yourself the way you normally would again. So that's good for anybody who thinks that they may be affected seasonally. And the light boxes you can buy aren't too expensive, and you can keep them for years. The bulbs last about 5 years. It's a good investment.
It's good to know there's relief there. I don't think she was asking about it in terms of fault, though, but in this day and age, people move around a lot. Are there patterns of people who move from climates that are sunnier, warmer, closer to the equator to others, or maybe even the other way around? Are they more vulnerable because they grew up in one environment and moved to another?
You know, that's a good point. I do think that is true. People who move from a sunnier climate to a place that's less so, where the difference between the amount of sunlight in the summer versus the winter, if it's more than about 3 or 4 hours difference, you're definitely going to be vulnerable to some kind of a shift in your moods just due to the lack of light. So it does depend a little bit on what you're used to. It also depends a little bit on your seasonal sensitivity and your resilience, and then what you do. Sitting in front of big bright windows, or at least outside as much as you can, does help.
Here's a Facebook question that may be another version, sort of extreme version of the same question in a way. James says, is there any correlation between one's birthday and seasonal affective disorder? He's not from Hawaii, but wonders if just where you sort of come on the planet in the cycle of seasons affects how you respond to those seasons later.
That's a fascinating question, and counterintuitively, the answer is that there is no correlation.
Huh.
So people think, hey, I'm born in the fall, I'm resilient in the fall,
yeah.
Or maybe as you decide you don't want to celebrate your birthday, perhaps, you know, someone asked Mae West, how old are you? She said somewhere between 40 and death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the idea is maybe you don't want to celebrate it, maybe it's going to be a bummer on the calendar. It turns out it is not a consistent factor. It depends on you, and it doesn't have anything to do with seasonal affective disorder.
Here's another little bit John Sharp has used from Elizabeth Strout, terrific writer, from Olive Kittredge. When she came back, the sun was just past its peak, and it was a bad time of day for her. It'd be better when it got dark. How she had loved the long evenings of spring when she was young, and all of life stretched before her. Writers know how to get into this issue. Louise in East Boston, you're on the air, Louise. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks. I just want to say a couple of things. I am one of these odd ducks that I love the winter. I love the spring, summer, and fall.
I could
never live anywhere that doesn't have four seasons.
Good, okay.
Four distinct seasons.
Okay.
But even so, because of lifetime depression, I use a light therapy box. And I'll tell you, I love it. And my only regret is that I didn't get one years ago.
It doesn't seem seasonal to you, but you've had depression across seasons and it helps no matter what?
Yes, yes. In fact, if we have, you know, say several days of rain where the sun does not come out, I pull out my light box and I start using it. What, you know, June, July, it doesn't matter.
Great idea, actually. There's new research showing that light does help non-seasonal depression as well. So you are getting a great fix. You know, the opposite would be if you weren't, you know, if it was non-seasonal and you weren't getting relief, then, you know, you could consult with your doctor about the possibility of, you know, considering some antidepressant treatment if needed. There is one medication which is indicated for seasonal affective disorder, actually, but all the antidepressants can help if someone's really clinically depressed, bogged down at a different time of the year.
Do people do that? Do they hop on an antidepressant for a single season, then hop off again? Is that recommended sometimes?
You know, there is one. And in order to get that drug approved, it's bupropion, which is the brand Wellbutrin. The drug company had to show that it would be useful in prevention. So people who had seasonal depression would go on it before they got affected by that dip in their mood and were prevented actually from having that same dip.
How bad does it have to be before a psychiatrist like yourself would prescribe an actual drug to deal with a seasonal issue?
Well, it depends on two things. One is your functioning. You know, if you're really having symptoms and you're impaired in your functioning, then I think it does make sense to talk to someone like me to just kind of consider your options. The other is to consider where you are in that spectrum of, on the one hand, hey, man, we're all chemicals, so whatever you want is fine. And on the other extreme, it'd be like, not unless I absolutely have to take it. I'd rather not have anything that's not natural for me.
Mm-hmm.
So you ask yourself, where are you in that spectrum? And then you ask yourself, how are you functioning? And you can talk to your doctor about it, see what the options are.
Interesting. Here along the light thread, here's Yar in Somerset, Kentucky says, can you address light color and the circadian clock? The day starts and ends with reds going to yellows and blues over the natural light cycle. Artificial light, including night laptop use, messes with the clock, he suggests. It changes our hormone cycles and can disrupt sleep. What about all the fluorescent light, the laptop, the computer screen light, all that? Does it get in the way of the color of light that our mind, our emotions may be connected with?
That's an advanced question, and you know, the jury's not in on that. I mean, intuitively, it makes sense that if you're exposed to kind of unnatural light, that it might not have a natural effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
There's some research now into the color blue as being useful in light boxes. There are some light boxes for SAD that use blue light. But the real experts in pure seasonal affective disorder research claim that the best thing is full spectrum light, not tanning, but other than that, full spectrum 10,000 lux is all you need. So I suspect intuitively kind of odd light exposure might make you feel a little odd, but there's no clear science proving that.
Interesting question. We may be hearing more about that as we spend more and more time, it seems, on all kinds of screens with their light. Let's go to Fred in Georgia. He's on I-65 North. Hi, Fred. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. John.
Hi.
How are you all doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Well, I'm originally from the South, and I can echo Rick's sentiments about being a Southerner and having this short but foreboding winter. Opposite of a previous caller earlier in the show, I went up to a small liberal arts college and was a psychology major in Ohio.
Okay.
And it was just brutally cold all winter, and it was nothing like I'd ever seen. And I was pretty intimidated, but I found a group of friends that was from the north, and they kind of helped me deal with the winters the first few years. But as the work piled up and I was fixing to graduate,
mm-hmm.
you know, I found myself in more solitude. And eventually, the winter got to me, and I left a semester before I graduated.
Sort of driven out by the dark and the cold.
And it just didn't fit on that day, so I stopped wearing it and moved hour north of, I moved to Austin, Texas to get out of it.
Can I comment that before you did that move, though, you were doing a great job of trying to figure out how to adjust to the winter, and you found yourself some winter mentors. That's something that I suggest in the emotional calendar, is find yourself some seasonal guide, not someone who's so far-fetched into it that you can't relate, but somebody who you can relate to. Try on what they're doing, see if it works for you. But a seasonal mentor helps a lot.
But Fred's also suggesting just how tough this can be. I mean, in the end, who knows, the combination of cultural things, I don't know, friends, family you're away from, but that dark and cold, he feels, got the best of him. It had a real impact on him.
And I'm glad you moved. You know what? It's not easy for me to suggest to a patient, or, you know, hey, why don't you move? Why don't you change jobs? Why don't you not have more children? You know, those kind of heavy personal life decisions are best made very personally and kind of through a lot of thought. But sometimes you do have to think like that, and you don't have to suffer forever. You know, if you were really suffering every winter, why not get ready to make a change for the better for the rest of your life? So good job.
His story reminds us, though, that it's really no joke. There's real-world consequences, or can be, to this if you can't quite get around it. Let's get
Absolutely.
A caller from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Michael. You're on the air, Michael. Thanks for calling.
Hello. How are you doing?
Pretty well. What's your story?
I'm kind of opposite of some of the people who've called in. I do really good in the winter. My body really turns off during the summertime. And I function better in less light than during the daytime. I'm more productive work-wise and when I wrote my dissertation. And I just wanted to know what y'all thought about that.
About summer-phobic people or people who have more trouble then. What about it, John? Thanks, Michael.
There is something called reverse SAD, where people have a hard time in the summer. Sometimes the light is just too much, or the kind of unfocused expectation is just too difficult. Summer SAD, unlike winter SAD, has a lot to do with not only light but also cultural expectations of the summertime. Some people have a harder time just getting to what they need to get done. But in this example, what you're saying is that the light was even too much and you liked a kind of more dim, focused environment. And I think that that's natural for you. You know, that has to do with your, what I would say is seasonal sensitivity.
And one more caller, Linda from Scituate, Massachusetts. Linda, thanks. You're on the air.
Hello there. How
Hi.
Are you?
Pretty well. What do you know, Linda?
A variety of experiences, I guess. I grew up in North Dakota, and
so you're not impressed by the cold snap here lately if you grew up in North Dakota?
Not so much. No. Actually, there was a great deal of discussion on Facebook this morning with my North Dakota friends, and the idea that we had a two-hour delay start to our school because of the cold. It's now 8 degrees, and my parents, like many parents in our area, had a policy of if it was 10 degrees or above, we walked to school.
Hello, Dakotas.
You're hale and hearty.
Yes. I guess. But I do hear that moniker used quite a bit. The hearty New Englander title is given out, I think, a little bit too liberally. And I do fully agree that it's the daylight that eventually does get to everyone. We did have the severity of the winter there, but that's what drove me, I think, out of North Dakota, is the lack of light. And
right.
We have such a drastic swing. Our sun sets in the summer maybe about 9:45. You can still play catch in your yard a quarter after 10. It's light enough for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then comes the winter, it's pitch black going to school in the morning. And, of course, the 45 below wind chill doesn't help that in any way.
Yeah, you'll be down to 50 below in a hurry. Linda, our time is short, but we appreciate that. That's a kind of funny North Dakota challenge to the hardy label.
You can be resilient. You know, you can. Some cultures are even more resilient by maybe genetics. Iceland, for example, has lower rates of SAD than the state of Maine.
That is fascinating. Maybe they've been reading Thoreau out there. I'll give one more of these. You have such great ones. This is from Henry David Thoreau's journal. He says, live each season as it passes, breathe the air, drink the drink, taste the fruit, and resign yourself to the influences of each. Is that it in the answer, to roll with it, roll with the seasons? And presumably it's not that easy for everybody, but that's the general idea.
And really worth trying. You know, consider what that means for you. What do you like? What don't you like? What works? What doesn't work? You know, be active in shaping your way of moving through the seasons so that you feel happier, more fulfilled, and in control of your life. It really is not as simple as that, but basically with work, that's what you can achieve.
Active in the turning of the seasons. John Sharp's new book is The Emotional Calendar. Dr. Sharp, thanks for the book, and thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
It's been great. And listeners, thanks to you. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hilary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby, with help from Matt Baskin and Dean Russell. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Stay warm, get a little light, enjoy the winter if you can. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.